It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. I hope you'll join us. So we all had a lot of fun this month watching the World Cup soccer games from Russia. So much fun that it was tempting to forget how the World Cup got to Russia. The system was rigged by soccer's governing organization, FIFA, and some of its member countries, and it took the United States to uncover it.
An unprecedented crisis for FIFA. A US investigation into football's governing body found it took bribes worth hundreds of millions of dollars over more than two decades to allocate tournaments and fix elections.
The fuller story is told in a new book by a Seattle native, actually. Pulitzer Prize finalist Ken Bensinger is an investigative reporter at BuzzFeed. The book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
By the way, Seattle even played a little tiny part in the soccer money laundering
That's story.
True. Yeah. Yeah. We'll get there. Okay. First of all, Ken, you call soccer the most corrupt sport in the world. Why is that? Why is soccer so corrupt?
Soccer happens to be the most popular sport in the world as well as the most corrupt, and I think those go hand in hand. It's extremely popular. We here in the States sometimes forget, but if you could imagine in countries like Brazil or England or France or all of Europe basically and most of South America, if you took every sports league in the U.S., every sport in the U.S. and combine them into one thing, that's all the people care about. And that's what it's like in those countries. So it's incredibly, the cultural currency of the sport is gigantic. And it actually has great economic and political power in those countries as well. And with that incredible muscle and popularity comes a lot of money. And unfortunately, in so many human endeavors, with so much money comes a lot of temptation for corruption. And because of the reach of this sport, it's played in 200 plus countries in the world. It's everywhere. The corruption is everywhere. It's hard to find anything, no matter how corrupt, that's that broad-reaching.
Well, I mean this to sound as ignorant as it is, because I don't understand it really, but it's just a game. So I know, as you said, it's hugely popular and lucrative and international. But does that mean it has to be allowed to be that corrupt, or why did it? And if not, why? Why has it been so corrupt for so long and allowed to stay that way?
Right. It wasn't corrupt for many, many years, or at least not in a big way.
Oh, really?
But it became corrupt when big money came into the sport. So in the 1970s, until about 1975, the sport was pretty quiet, not a lot of corruption happening. And then the big corporate interests came in, the Coca-Colas, the Fuji films, and then the television. So a few years later, when the technology improved for international color simulcast broadcasting, suddenly massive mountains of oceans of money start pouring into the game. And the people who are the middlemen, the brokers of all these deals, end up discovering that they're better off paying bribes than allowing things to compete in sort of an open market. And so ultimately, the corruption in the culture of the sport comes from the desire of middlemen to make more money off the sport and to deny it sort of a free market approach to it. So we see this, it's basically a controlled, cheated market where bribes are paid to keep people out.
Would you give an example of how colorful, how creative and epic this bribery can become? You have so many stories in your book. Give us a flavor.
Yeah. So, I mean, the bribery ends up becoming a very complicated, sophisticated system over the decades. And you're having bribes on almost every commercial deal, almost every television deal. And you're having people go to great lengths to hide this because they know that it's not okay. They know that no matter what they say, it's not all right. So one example would be that there was a Paraguayan who was taking millions of dollars in bribes, but he didn't want to get caught.
Bribes for what?
For signing contracts that would cede commercial rights to tournaments, right?
So okay.
he was in charge of a part of all of South American soccer rights. So he would sign over television deals and sponsorship deals and would take millions of dollars in bribes to steer them to one company or another. Mm-hmm. But he didn't want to be connected to the bribes. And so he would ask for them in cash, but he didn't want to travel across international borders with cash either. So he would have his personal driver drive from Asunción, Paraguay to Buenos Aires, Argentina, where the bribes were being paid. And the guy would drive 15 hours in a pickup truck or something, or in a minivan. And then he would get there, spend the night and drive right back 15 hours back with $200,000 in cash in the trunk of the car. And he would do this over and over and over again. That's the kind of thing they would go to. That's the length they would go to hide the bribes. But there's also bribes negotiated sort of in things that seem like in a mafia movie. There was bribes negotiated at abandoned gas stations in dangerous neighborhoods late at night with sort of a single light bulb hanging on a string. And we're talking about millions of dollars. And then there was betrayals in these bribe things where people would be taking bribes And their colleagues would think they were taking the same amount of bribe, but in fact, they had secretly negotiated a larger bribe and kept the other one out. So it really ends up feeling, when you understand the culture of it, very much like something out of the Italian mafia or something.
People being bribed in Paul McCartney tickets.
Ah, yes. That's a good example.
Which may or may not have happened.
May or may not have happened, but there was the
concert, that is, may or may not have happened.
Right. So there was a trial in this case. The case... which came into public view, started in 2010, came into public view in 2015 and went to trial in late 2017. One of the people was alleged to have taken bribes as VIP tickets to rock and roll shows. And as a fun side note, during the trial, which I covered, I went to the bathroom once, and in front of the sink was this defendant who was being accused of taking tickets to Paul McCartney shows. And the rumor had been flying around that Elton John was his favorite artist, and we started talking, and he started telling me how much he loved Elton John and that his best friend was a huge Billy Joel fan. It was really surreal to be at the federal trial of this guy, and he's telling me about Elton John. In any event, he was allegedly taking bribes in part in the form of $10,000 VIP tickets to this concert, and his attorneys, the prosecution was talking about this, his attorneys refused to admit that that concert ever took place. Not that he took the bribes. That was for the jury to decide. But whether the concert even took place, the defendants wouldn't stipulate to that. And the rules of evidence in court say you can't just stand up and show a Google page and say this happened. So they needed a witness to attest to the fact that the concert was real. And so the prosecution, which was tired of fighting with this very resistant defense, called a very unusual guest. They called one of the Jonas Brothers. So in what was kind of the most bizarre moment of a very bizarre trial, Kevin Jonas, the Jonas Brothers, was a government witness, and he testified to the fact that indeed there was a concert. He had been in Buenos Aires with the rest of the Jonas Brothers to go. They were performing the next night, and Paul McCartney had invited them to the show. So his time on the stand lasted about 3 minutes. The defense had no cross-examination, and it was over. And the jury, you could see their heads spinning. It was a bizarre little moment.
So it's kind of absurd, and I catch myself laughing about it a little bit. But so maybe I should stop for a moment and say, for people who don't take this that seriously, don't care who wins the World Cup or who hosts it because it's just a game, will you make the case why sports corruption matters a lot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, well, obviously if people care about the sport, it matters because it affects the way they think about it. But beyond that, we can think about the social and public good of sport as an institution, right? Sometimes we think about sport only in terms of it being where the pros play in the World Cup or the different tournaments, but also one of the concepts of soccer as it's envisioned under FIFA. FIFA is the organization that oversees all world soccer. One of the concepts is to develop the sport and make it accessible to as many people as possible. And one of the ways we could think about that is children playing the sport, women playing the sport, amateurs who just want to play for a good time. And all this corruption we're starting to talk about denies money that could go and filter down to these groups. And so we may not care about the sport writ large, but we all sort of might agree that little kids, if they want to play it, and I'm not just talking about here in Seattle and, you know, in Kirkland or something, but children in South Africa, children in South America, children in different parts of the world that don't have a lot of resources should be given the chance to do it. And I can tell you, having traveled a lot, particularly in South America, there's many children who have no resources, no fields to play on, no cleats to wear on their feet, no balls. There are 200 plus countries, as I said before, that play men's soccer at the highest level, but only about four dozen that play women's soccer at the highest level. It's an obvious iniquity. And one of the reasons is because a lot of countries don't put the resources they could into developing the women's game. So women are prevented from having the sport. Another reason, and this is one of the reasons that the Department of Justice would enunciate, is that this is the way that the corruption is conducted is through international money laundering and through defrauding financial institutions. And their argument is we should care about the crime in the sport because it's a crime the way we care about other crimes. They are taking advantage of institutions we're supposed to have faith in to commit crimes, to launder money, to hide it. I mean, you may recall the Panama Papers from a couple of years ago. This is all intimately tied into it. Many of the people whose names came up in the Panama Papers are also involved in FIFA corruption. And the law firms, the Panamanian law firms that were doing these deals, part of their book of business was hiding money for soccer corruption. And a final piece, of course, is that there's an international sort of geopolitical piece of this. It's very hard to separate the way the soccer operates from a lot of geopolitical stuff. And we may discuss that later in this time, but so many events over the last few decades that seem to have a political scale end up having a small piece that's soccer. And people who end up as world leaders often start out in some of these countries in soccer. As an example, the current president of Argentina got his start as the president of the country's most popular soccer club. The former president of Honduras was indicted in this case, and a sitting member of Guatemala's Supreme Court was also indicted. So people who go on to bigger and better and more important things are often tied up in this web of corruption.
This is Ken Bensinger. The book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. So some of us may remember 2015, these high-profile arrests, a hotel in Zurich, and money laundering and racketeering. How, basic, in a nutshell, how did that scandal come to light?
It came to light because of the arrests, right? It had been a secret investigation.
I should say, what got that investigation rolling? What led to that?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting story, and it was one that the government tried to keep secret for a very long time. But back in 2010, which seems like decades ago, there was interest inside the FBI, which was then directed by Robert Mueller, to search for transnational crime, what he called transnational crime, which had to do with different kinds of financial crimes that cross borders. And an FBI squad in New York that specialized in Russian organized crime was looking for cases. And they had been building a case involving an illegal poker room and gambling ring, online gambling ring, sports gambling, that was housed partially in the Trump Tower in New York. And they had a wiretap in the Trump Tower, and they were doing all kinds of looking at how this was involved. And it turned out that the person who was financing it all, sort of the ringleader of this whole operation, was a Russian gangster. And this Russian gangster, they were trying to get information on him. He had been previously indicted in the U.S. for, of all things, bribing figure skating judges at the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City so that Russians would win and beat people from other countries. And so these FBI agents, there was an FBI agent who had spent his career busting the Genovese Italian crime family in Brooklyn, had moved to the Russian crime squad. He goes to London to find information about this Russian gangster. While he's there, he meets, he's introduced to a former MI6 British spy. And that spy has the name Christopher Steele.
Yeah. Steele dossier.
Christopher Steele at the time had just left the MI6, was not a particularly well-known and not at all known figure at the time, but he was a real expert in Russia. And they met together, and the FBI agent says, "I'm interested in cases involving Russia and transnational crime. If you hear anything, let me know." Goes back to New York. And a few months later, Christopher Steele calls him up and says, "You should come back to London." And the reason he did this is because one of Christopher Steele's first clients in private practice was the English Football Association, their soccer association, which was bidding to host the 2018 World Cup, the one we just saw in Russia. England had been competing against Russia and a few other countries to have this right. And they had hired Chris Steele to do research on the different bidding countries, in particularly Russia. What Chris Steele was finding was that Russia was cheating, essentially, that Russia was doing anything it could to win the World Cup and breaking all kinds of FIFA rules, definitely, but potentially international laws or different laws in different countries. And he says to the FBI agent, "You might want to look into this FIFA thing." The FBI agent had never even really heard of FIFA, but it sounded like the kind of thing he wanted to do. He went back to Brooklyn and opened a case, went back to New York and then found a prosecutor in Brooklyn who would take the case. And that's how it began. So it really began as an investigation of Russian corruption and Russian attempts to use FIFA and to co-opt FIFA rules to steal the World Cup, which ultimately was successful. About 6 months after the FBI opened its investigation, FIFA held its vote. And lo and behold, although everyone thought England should have sort of on technical merits hosted the World Cup, Russia won the World Cup. And the FBI agents who were just beginning to build up their case felt vindicated in their idea and really started pushing ahead hard at that point. So that's the origin story of the case.
Okay, so we've just heard the names Robert Mueller, a Trump Tower, Russian gangster, Russian meddling, Christopher Steele of the famous Steele dossier regarding what Russia might have on Donald Trump. There are more coming up in your book. James Comey is in there, et cetera. Vladimir Putin. What are the parallels between this investigation, the FIFA soccer investigation, and the special counsels?
Right. Well, one obviously is the roots with Russia and Christopher Steele. Christopher Steele ends up being at an important fulcrum in both cases. There's no doubt that the FIFA case, as it's called, the U.S. criminal investigation of soccer corruption would never have started without Christopher Steele. And we can think of him creating what you might think of as a FIFA dossier to provide information to the FBI. Mm-hmm. That's also critical because it creates a relationship between him and the FBI and this particular FBI agent. And it turns out the FBI, they're not particularly trusting folks. It's hard for them to build relationships with people and just take information cold. The FBI gets thousands of tips all the time that it completely disregards because it doesn't know who the source is and doesn't trust them. That's really important and pivotal later when, in 2016, Christopher Steele has this dossier of things he thinks Trump and Russia might have done together to sway the election, because he already has this relationship with the FBI. And if he didn't have that existing relationship, it's very clear, very likely that they never would have taken the dossier seriously. And you start spinning, the dominoes falling from that are pretty massive. If the Steele dossier didn't exist or wasn't taken seriously by the FBI, it's hard to imagine that many of the things we've been seeing over the last year and a half happening could have ever happened. I'm not saying there's not other evidence that is at play, because of course there is. And we've learned, for example, that this guy, Papadopoulos, for example, may have even triggered the investigation prior to the FBI having the dossier. But it's also clear, as we've seen from things like the FISA warrant on Carter Page, that so many pieces of this investigation wouldn't exist without the dossier playing a role. So that's really critical. And then, of course, Mueller being involved, Mueller's entire philosophy of fighting crime was at play in creating the FIFA case. And that same philosophy is clearly at play now in the special counsel investigation that he's leading. This week, we're supposed to see the criminal trial of Paul Manafort begin. Mm-hmm. If you look at the way that case seems to be constructed, it's very similar to the way the FIFA case was constructed, which is a money laundering case, which is following money between countries. We see the money from the Ukraine going through all kinds of middlemen, through Cyprus and elsewhere, and then ending up with Manafort. It's very similar to the way that the FIFA criminals are doing something. And so there's kind of a dialogue, if you will, between those two things. It's also not an accident that many prosecutors who had a small to medium-sized hand in the FIFA case now work under Robert Mueller. The lead prosecutor in the FIFA case does not, but his supervisor works for Mueller now. And a woman that the lead prosecutor in the FIFA case supervised, she now works for Mueller. So many of the people who are trained in the Eastern District of New York, which is Brooklyn, in a similar way of busting mafia, are all working for Mueller. And that's very much a spirit in that investigation.
So then, Ken, does your extensive knowledge here that began with the soccer investigation, does that tell you anything that you want to tell us about what to expect from the Mueller investigation?
Right. I don't have a crystal ball on those kind of things. And I often feel like every day one has a different emotional feeling about what's going to come out of that investigation. But I think it's pretty clear that there is a playbook to these kind of cases. You know, we're seeing it writ large. I mean, in the FIFA case, the goal was to roll people, get enough evidence on people that they could turn them into you know, cooperating witnesses. That is to say, sort of informants, as we might say in street language, to flip these people and make them do the dirty work, give the information, secretly record people, and then roll the thing forward to get more people. And using indictments not just as a statement of what they've done research on, but actually to create more criminal acts and to create more investigation material to use. That's how they did the FIFA case. That seems to be how they're doing the Mueller case. So I think, you know, it's clear there's a strong effort to try to get people to flip, and there's a strong effort to use financial records and now apparently recordings, just like was the case in the FIFA case, to potentially prove to a jury what they believe to be true.
Again, we're talking with Ken Bensinger, and the book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. So you talked about how the Russia World Cup was ill-gotten in a sense, but the cup, as we just saw it played, was post-scandal, so it was squeaky clean?
I don't think anything in FIFA, unfortunately, is squeaky clean.
Oh.
I mean, a good example of that would be our friend Vladimir Putin. You know, it's clear that he played a dirty role in getting the World Cup to Russia, which was an important priority for him. In 2010, he was prime minister. He had stepped down from the presidency because of their rules about re-election, wanted to run again, wanted to be able to win the World Cup, so that he could, in 2012, when he ran for president again, sort of hold that up as a reason to vote for him. It was successful. And then he wanted the World Cup as a way to project to the world, after he'd won domestically, his power. He wins re-election a second time, or however many times, if you add it all up, in March, 75% of the vote, which is an incredible number if you think about it. And now the World Cup is his chance to show the world what he's done. Well, one of the most laughing at the world moment, I think, of the World Cup was when Putin invited the former president of FIFA to come to Russia and be his personal guest. That's important because the former president of FIFA had been kicked out of the game by FIFA in the wake of the U.S. criminal investigation. His name is Sepp Blatter, and he was so wrapped up in all this corruption, he had no choice but to resign and then was kicked out of the sport for 6 years. The rules of soccer say that if you're kicked out of sport, you're not supposed to go to any events, but Putin didn't care. He invited him anyway and really thumbed his nose at the world. And we don't really know how deep the corruption was in the Russian World Cup. FIFA hired an outside lawyer, a former American prosecutor, to run an investigation of the World Cup bidding at that point. When they visited Russia to ask them to see their books, to see, explain where all the money went, whether there were bribes, Russia said, well, it's a funny thing. The computers we used for the bid were borrowed. And after the World Cup was over, we returned them to their owner and they were destroyed. There's no records left. Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, it turns out they were borrowed from one of Putin's best friends, right? And they were completely destroyed. And FIFA's response was, well, you know, if there's no records, there must not have been any corruption. And they gave him a clean bill of health. We'll never really know. It's very clear that shady things happened. One more example, if I can. Egypt, which was playing against Russia, which for those who follow the sport, Russia did very much better as a team than everyone expected.
Yeah.
Egypt, they played in the first round, had a superstar, maybe the best scorer in the world right now, a guy named Mohamed Salah. That they're practicing prior to the World Cup, where they warmed up and trained, was in Chechnya, which is a dictatorship run by one of the scariest people in the world. And there's all these pictures of the guys practicing with the dictator looking over their shoulder and personally escorting Salah to and from matches. Well, lo and behold, Russia beat the pants off of Egypt when they played them in the first round. So at the very least, there's incredible material for conspiracy theorists.
Mm-hmm. And what was, since I mentioned it at the beginning, what was Seattle's little tiny piece of the money laundering scandal?
So there's all these deals we talked about before where there's rights being ceded for probably below value because of bribes being paid. One of these bribes was a couple $100,000 bribe that was paid by a media rights company out of Miami to some Central American, Guatemalan, I believe, soccer officials. And the way to hide the money, rather than wiring it to these people directly, was to send it through intermediaries. In this case, it was a construction firm here in Seattle. And so in 2014, in March, about $200,000 was wired from a bank in Miami through a U.S. construction firm in Seattle and then off to Central America. And so it's a small but important role. And the government used that to prove that particular conspiracy. And, you know, prosecutors came to Seattle. Everyone was interviewed at the construction firm, that sort of thing. So it really reached as far as here.
There was a lot of money washing around in Seattle construction.
Apparently, yes, there was. I mean, it's right. It's a good place to hide money because there's a lot of money washing through the industry.
Yeah. Has this corruption, one last question maybe, has this, all this soccer FIFA corruption, does it seem to affect how much people love the game? Like, just for example, in Seattle, it doesn't seem to affect how Seattleites feel about the game, as far as I can tell. I'll just put it that way. Is it a cancer on the game? You know, they describe scandals as being like that.
I mean, I think it is a cancer in the game, and I think it is bad for the sport. But I think one of the ironies of it, and one of the reasons that these people could get away with it for so long, which they did, and why there's so much impunity in the sport, is because people love it so unabashedly. And when the World Cup comes around, for example, everyone forgets all their grumbling about how corrupt it is and just gets engaged in this tournament. And I don't know the numbers, but over a billion people, several billion people, or eyeballs watch the World Cup tournament.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I went to the Sounders game yesterday and I had a great time. I went with my son and there was 40,000 people there and it was fun and the Sounders won 3-1 and that was terrific. And so, you know, I think there's a hope. I think the prosecution felt this way too, which is, can we separate the fact that the sport can be a good thing and just the people who are running it are not so good? And can we get that cancer off of it and keep the body alive, right? Can you save the patient essentially and get rid of the problem? And that's the hope. And I think that's what fans want. I mean, there's a lot of people who are upset about the corruption and they feel like it's afflicting their love of the game, but at the same time, they love the game in its purest form. And so really, that's one of the reasons is that FIFA was never indicted. FIFA itself was never indicted. All these executives and officials of it were, but the sport, it wasn't. And that was a clear choice, which is to say, we can save this patient. We can save soccer. It's not going to happen overnight. We can reform it. We can push it. We can make changes. And over time, we can dream that it'll be a much cleaner thing.
Ken Bensinger is a Seattle native, a Sounders fan, a BuzzFeed investigative reporter, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and the latest book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. It's been great talking with you, Ken. Thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure. I want to say if people are interested, I will be reading tonight at Elliott Bay Books on Capitol Hill. The reading's at 7 o'clock tonight, and we'd really love people to come out and see me read. I'll be there answering questions after I read a little bit and signing books. And if you really want up for it, we might go around the corner and grab a drink, and I can talk to you about soccer all night long. So hope people can make it tonight.
That sounds like a good night. Ken Bensinger, Elliott Bay Books tonight, 7 o'clock. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks a lot, Bill.